President Trump spoke to the American Farm Bureau Federation in Nashville yesterday.
In our nation's former, and then you know that, our nation's farmers are just the most incredible people, and we are doing a job for you. You're seeing it like nobody else.
How will his new tax plan affect Illinois farmers? Plus, the state's high-speed rail project is in its final phase. Here's Amtrak spokesperson Mark Maglieri.
These locomotives will gain speed faster. They should operate a little more smoothly than the current locomotives.
But no one's coming aboard until safety measures are put in place. And Harry Potter was a fan of snowy owls, so our bird enthusiasts throughout Illinois, sightings of the rare bird are on the rise. But first, Caterpillar's tax woes. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're going to be talking taxes this morning, not personal income taxes. Instead, we're going to be focusing on corporate taxes and later in the hour, taxes affecting farmers. 10 months ago, federal officials raided Caterpillar's then headquarters in Peoria. At the time, the discussion was that investigators were specifically looking into information regarding overseas tax shelters and the company. Now we're learning more about that investigation. No charges have been filed yet, but the IRS says Caterpillar may that owe them up to $2 billion. That's because of a Swiss subsidiary the company might be using to pay less in taxes. That's according to a recent Wall Street Journal story on Caterpillar. Of course, Caterpillar is one of Illinois' largest and best known companies. Chicago-based reporter Andrew Tangle is on the line with us now. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks a lot. How are you?
Good. Thank you. This might seem like a complicated story because it involves corporate tax law and loopholes, but I thought we should maybe start with the basics of understanding the purpose of this Swiss subsidiary that Caterpillar set up back in 1999. And I wonder, if you answer that, you can also add what the IRS says about companies and these overseas subsidiaries.
Sure. So back in the late 90s, Caterpillar, like a lot of companies in the U.S., took steps to reduce their U.S. tax bill. They saw an opportunity with their parts business, the business they engage in of selling parts, replacement parts for these, you know, big bulldozers, mining trucks, and so forth that they sell to their overseas customers. And they saw that the U.S. Headquarters, U.S.-based entity, was an unnecessary link in that supply chain, and they had, going back since at least 1960, a Geneva, Switzerland office that was focused on expanding their overseas dealer network. And so through some restructuring, the company began booking most of the profits from overseas parts sales in Switzerland. So most of those profits after 99 were taxed at the much lower Swiss rate. I believe we reported that the rate was as low as 4%, the effective Swiss tax rate that had been negotiated. So much lower than the U.S. corporate rate at the time was of 35%. So the company has argued repeatedly over the years that, you know, the tax structure was reflecting their business structure, and they've taken steps over the years to move employees over to Switzerland. You know, it's a it's an office, and the questions have arisen over whether or not there's a business purpose for the profits on these overseas parts sales.
Right. Because I guess the right, Andrew, I guess the fact that for a and I wanted to ask you about that because we already know that lots of American companies have subsidiaries or overseas companies in order to pay less taxes on their profits, right? And I guess the question is why, and this is something that presidents have talked about, senators have talked about, this is always kind of a constant political issue as well, and it has been even more so, I feel like, in the past couple of years. Do we know why the IRS was specifically interested in this specific situation with Caterpillar?
The IRS hasn't said much publicly about this. Like other federal agencies, generally don't talk about matters that are under investigation on the criminal side or, as has been the case for many years, on the civil side, when they're examining or arguing with taxpayers over the amount they owe in taxes. But Caterpillar's situation is somewhat unique compared to other large multinational companies with tax reduction strategies. Unlike a tech company or a pharmaceutical company that may have intangible goods or assets overseas, like patents, trademarks, etc., Caterpillar's tax reduction strategy involved physical manufactured parts produced by third-party suppliers, and they essentially were, parts coming from Morton, Illinois, near Peoria's then headquarters, Caterpillar's then headquarters in Peoria. And so the owner of the parts bound overseas was this Geneva office, this Geneva subsidiary of Caterpillar. And so...
But the parts were made here in Illinois. It sounds like you're saying that, but the parts were actually manufactured in the U.S.,
The parts may not have been manufactured in Illinois. These parts are, I believe, specifically third-party manufactured parts. So, Caterpillar makes some of its own replacement parts, but also has a number of suppliers that sell the parts to Caterpillar. Caterpillar sells the parts to its dealer in wherever overseas, and when it will ship those parts from Morton, Illinois to a Caterpillar customer in Saudi Arabia or a dealer there that services the customer. And so you've got profits being made in Switzerland, even though the physical parts never went through Switzerland.
Ah, I
and
see.
That is mm-hmm. something that makes at least the Caterpillar case unique when it comes to these types of arrangements. And the IRS hasn't said that that's one reason why they are looking at Caterpillar in particular. They haven't said much publicly.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, we haven't yet seen any civil or criminal charges filed at this time. But I wanted to ask you, Andrew, from your reporting, it seems that there have been some employees who've been worried about this for a while. How far back do their concerns go, especially some Swiss employees of Caterpillar?
Well, the questions inside Caterpillar go back at least to the early 2000s. In the article that ran most recently, we talked to someone who was senior at the time, who said that that this arrangement appeared, to be just for tax avoidance purposes. This person couldn't get certain questions answered clearly. Later, there was an anonymous letter sent to the CEO at the time, threatening to go to the IRS if there wasn't an independent investigation. This anonymous letter writer raised questions about whether or not the tax reduction policy, the structure complied with U.S. tax law. So there have been questions internally, and then later there was also a lawsuit filed by
a former employee,
right, who claimed that he was demoted as retaliation for raising concerns about this policy. So there have been questions over the years, and obviously externally too. The IRS has a continuing sort of civil argument with Caterpillar over its tax bill. They're trying to collect $2 billion back taxes and fees. The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, has looked into this, but declined to pursue any type of enforcement action. And of course, now we've got a criminal investigation involving the Department of Commerce, the IRS, and also the FDIC, the bank regulator's Inspector General's office.
Right. So, Andrew, we have all these different investigations going on. I should note to our audience, we did reach out to Caterpillar. They did respond to us and say that their comment on this is reflected in the Wall Street Journal piece, and they don't have anything further to add. Andrew, what did Caterpillar tell you in response to your story?
They said that they believe that their tax position is right, and that's what they've told the Senate subcommittee that investigated this the Swiss structure in 2014. They said they're cooperating with the government, and they hope that this matter is behind them as quickly as possible.
Andrew, one last question for you. I imagine that you are kind of keeping an eye on this at the Journal, and other folks are, as wondering if this will have implications for other companies as well in terms of their overseas business interests and tax implications.
Right. It depends on how this plays out. Nothing could come of this criminal investigation. Generally speaking, there are a number of matters that are investigated by the government, closed, and everyone just moves on. And there are a lot of factors that go into whether or not there's any type of administrative, civil, or criminal case that is made. So if there is some sort of action taken by the government that could have implications for other companies, but it remains to be seen what the government thinks could be done wrong here, if there is anything. It's playing out against the backdrop of a new tax law in this country. So it'll be interesting to see what, if anything, becomes of the government's investigation. But also it'll be interesting to see what companies, including Caterpillar, do with their overseas operations in light of the new tax law.
That's Andrew Tangle, a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Andrew, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Speaking of that new tax law, President Trump was actually talking about that yesterday when he spoke to nearly 5,000 people at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention in Tennessee. These are campaign style appearances. And President Trump said he was promoting his tax overhaul he signed into law last month. And he said the benefits from it would mainly go to small family farmers.
In our nation's former, and then you know that our nation's farmers are just the most incredible people, and we are doing a job for you. Regulation, death tax, so much. You're a big beneficiary, and you're really producing like nobody else. So I just want to thank you for that. And that's why I'm so honored to be the first president to address the American Farm Bureau in more than 25 years. What happened? Where are they? What happened?
That's President Trump yesterday at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention. We wanted to hear reactions to the speech and to President Trump's policies from Illinois farmers. Let's start with farmer Paul Taylor. He's a corn, soybean, and specialty crop farmer in Esmond near DeKalb, where he farms about 850 acres. Hey, Paul Taylor, welcome back to the 21st. Happy New Year.
Well, good morning and Happy New Year to you folks as well.
We've just got about a minute before we take a break here, Paul, but I just wanted to, Paul Taylor, I just wanted to start by just asking you if you heard President Trump's speech yesterday. I imagine you did. You were watching with friends. What was your immediate reaction?
Well, I did not hear the speech in the entirety, and of course I did hear excerpts from it, and I heard a comment a few minutes ago that it was a campaign-style speech, and I say bravo for him. We all need encouragement, particularly in the field of agriculture right now. And I think he's come through with a lot of his promises for the red states. I think he's some of his tax bill has included some things that are going to be good for agriculture and the rural community and our family in the long term.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Paul Taylor. We're also going to be joined by another corn farmer, Paul Jeske, and Grant Gerlach. He's a reporter with Harvest Public Media, are going to be joining us to talk a little bit more about how this tax code is going to affect rural communities across the country. We're also going to continue to get reaction to President Trump's speech yesterday at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about President Trump's speech yesterday, his appearance at the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention. First time in a long time that a sitting president has addressed American farmers. We're getting reactions from some Illinois farmers. We've been speaking with Paul Taylor. He farms near DeKalb County, corn and soy. I want to welcome also Paul Jeske, who's with us. He's a corn farmer from Muzzin, Illinois, where he also farms about 4,000 acres with his brother-in-law and nephew's family. Paul Jeske, welcome back to the 21st. Happy New Year to you, too.
And the same to you. Good to be with you this morning.
Now, I know you had plenty of colleagues who were in Nashville in person watching the speech, but I understand you were texting lots of folks as he was talking. What stood out to you from what the president said in his address to farmers yesterday, Paul Jeske?
Well, the main thing, I think, was an appreciation of his acknowledgement of what agriculture is for this country, the hard work we do, the contributions we make to the military, the loyalty, the patriotism. As you mentioned before, when you were talking to Mr. Taylor, it was a campaign-style speech in many ways. There were some specifics, but in general, just that acknowledgement that he recognizes the part that the American farmers and rural America plays, that in and of itself was a feel-good thing, and you know, everybody likes to be appreciated, so we appreciated that recognition.
And Paul Jeske, as I mentioned, it's been some time since a sitting president has addressed the American Farm Bureau Federation's annual convention. Do you think that that in itself is a significant moment to farmers, that President Trump took the time to come to the convention?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a recognition that rural America did support him in a large percentage. Rural America was looking for some changes in the direction that the government was playing for us. And so, yes, I think many were kind of wondering, it's about a year into his presidency now. Is he remembering some of the folks that helped to put him where he's at, and some of the policies? Trade is something that we're very, very concerned about possibly losing, and he's been kind of verbally hard, obviously NAFTA being the big one. So it was good to have him come and recognize our presence, recognize at least in words how important he knows trade is to the American farmers. And so that's something we were hoping to hear, and hope that it carries through in what his actions actually are in the NAFTA negotiations.
Paul Jeske, I know we've talked to you about trade on the program before. In fact, I believe it was almost exactly a year ago, right after or just around the inauguration, where we talked about your concerns and certainly some that are shared by many across the agricultural industry, concern about President Trump's trade policies. Did he indicate anything yesterday? Mostly we've just heard lots of statements from the president. We haven't, in terms of trade, we haven't seen any actual policies in terms of what changes that have been made. Are you still worried about what may happen with trade in agriculture?
Certainly. We're still very concerned. The crops that we've grown the last several years have been huge, and our surpluses for our grains have been increasing. And the use that we have at home for those commodities is kind of static. It's slowly, very, very slowly growing, but our production is outpacing that growth. So we're very, very dependent on exports to try and help use up those surpluses and prop up the prices a bit. So what we heard yesterday were words, acknowledgement of him knowing that we feel NAFTA is very important, but the proof will only show up when we actually have the new agreement signed, or hopefully an agreement signed, and see what's in that deal.
Paul Taylor, for you, in the past year, as this, as Paul Jeske's talking about sort of the year under the Trump administration, wondering if he's still paying attention to rural America, I wonder for you, what do you feel, Paul Taylor, have been the positives and negatives for farmers and for you in this first year of the Trump administration?
Well, I think on one level, some would say there hasn't been a lot going on in Washington. There's many of us in agriculture think that there's been a number of things. Of course, the flagship event, if you will, was the tax legislation right before Christmas. But maybe at a more subdued level is the president's dealing with many, many regulations, which many of us in agriculture have felt they've become overburdensome, particularly issues with the example of the waters of the U.S. I know there's concern. We have concerns. We live in the communities as farmers. We're concerned about, as an example, environmental things. But those, I think his actions on the regulation side has probably been one of the strongest ones and most visible for us in rural America.
Mm-hmm. Paul Jeske, do you see negatives to the Trump administration? We talked about trade. Are there other things that have concerned you about the Trump administration so far?
Well, I think there's more positive than negatives. I'm not always wild, as many of us aren't, on sometimes some of the tweets, some of the rhetoric that comes out. But the actions, as Mr. Taylor is pointing out, have been, in general, very positive for agriculture. I don't think we can hardly emphasize enough to off-farm folks how this regulatory burden that seems to maybe be shifting a little bit here, how significant that is for us. The amount of time that we spend filling out paperwork, proving what we are or are not doing on our farms to show the government entities that we have interaction with. It's like the government and EPA don't think our time has any value at all. And Waters of the U.S. was a great example, as Mr. Taylor talked about, where that was an extremely significant regulatory burden that was coming down. Many of us had received maps showing what the government was going to lay claim on our property, where they would say that they would have the right to regulate that very small stream, or in many cases, bodies of water that were only there for a few days after a rain or whatever. And I mean, that was extremely insulting to think our private property rights were going to be encumbered by the government on those types of issues. So that attitude shift, or their have made major pullbacks. I mean, that's to us, or to me personally, I maybe should speak, that feels like a huge ship that has been turned now, that was heading dead for me.
Yeah, and it sounds like a huge relief for you as well.
Extremely, extremely. So, yeah, some of the rhetoric has been worrisome, but I think in general, most of the folks that I know, and myself certainly, feel that the actions, while I completely agree with Mr. Taylor, there's not been a lot of policy shifts or a lot of policy that's taken place, new things. What has is probably been definitely more positive than negative for the American farmer.
And Paul Taylor, let me ask you about what has taken place, which is the tax bill. The president talked about that he signed last month. How will that affect you and your farm?
Well, I think that as I think about it, of course, everybody likes reductions in their tax rates, and that's incorporated in there. I'll leave the conversation. It's such a huge volume with hundreds and hundreds of pages. I'll let the experts, if you will, argue out if this is more beneficial to the rich and ultimately whether there is a pass-down effect of that economic multiplier, the rising, the tide lifts all boats, so to speak. But I think more importantly is a couple things for us. One is the uncertainty that we've had, particularly with planning, with estate planning and transition planning for our farms. I use the example that my father passed away in 1983. In order to avoid what we thought were burdensome estate taxes at that time, we set up some trusts and other things, and some would say, well, you didn't do it right, you didn't whatever, but we actually just unwound some of those a couple of years ago. So over 30 years later, we're still. So my point is when this stuff is complicated, overbearing, everybody, most people want to make some kind of reaction, and with the estate tax especially, the exemption's been raised. It's still going to apply to some in agriculture and many outside of agriculture, but it's going to reduce the need for us to spend a lot of time with our accountants and our attorneys, and that's one that Farm Bureau has been working on a long time. A couple other real quick ones are the certainty of the one, we call it the 179 expense election, where we can buy new equipment, put it into service, whether it's corn planters, grain bins, that sort of equipment to recapitalize our farms and keep it up to snuff, if you will, and be able to write that off, expense it quickly, if you will, instead of having to expense it over a number of years if we need that as a deduction. So that's kind of down in the weeds, but I think just helping us with reducing the uncertainty has been probably the number one thing.
Gentlemen, thank you for that. Paul Taylor, thank you especially for that. Paul Taylor farms near DeKalb County. I want to thank Paul Jeske as well in Grundy County for joining me, thank you for giving us a little bit more perspective on how you all as farmers are feeling about the Trump administration, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
Joined now by Grant Gerlach. He's a reporter with Harvest Public Media. That's a collaboration focused on food, ag, and other rural issues. He's on the line with us now from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Grant, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. So we've just been talking about this new tax bill policy. You just reported a piece on how this will affect farmers and rural hospitals. We were just listening to Paul Taylor talk about estate planning and the new tax bill and how he's hoping it will help them. How do you think smaller family farms, let's start with that, will fare under the new tax system that will go into effect in 2019?
Well, when it comes to a lot of family farms, it's sort of like a lot of other families. There's the standard deduction that could impact them. Most farms are set up as small businesses, so the tax cuts on the pass-through income that people talk about, that impacts a lot of farms. And the deductions you just heard about, writing off the cost of new equipment, that's something that has been pretty popular among farmers and also for equipment dealers out there also.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, though, in terms of how, as Paul Taylor alluded to, kind of the big what if in this bill in terms of how it affects farmers, he said he would leave it up to folks who spend a lot more time looking at policy and economic effects to think about whether it will spur as much economic growth as they say it will. In terms of other intangibles for how this tax bill might affect farmers, what are we looking at?
Well, I think the what ifs are, a lot of those center around how it ends up impacting the federal budget. That That comes into play for farms and farm policy. That comes into a play for a lot of other policies that support, as you mentioned, rural hospitals. So I'll cover a few of those. First of all, the Farm Bill is coming up. You heard mention of that, too. That's a huge bill that covers a wide range of things, from crop insurance to conservation programs to rural development programs to food and nutrition programs like SNAP, the food bill, the food stamp program. And they're already writing that bill, understanding that they're not going to be able to spend any more money. But the question now is if they'll have to plan for cuts and how that might impact farms. Yesterday, the president said he's committed to crop insurance, and that was greeted by applause by the people there at the Farm Bureau Convention. But the question is how much the government will subsidize those crop insurance premiums. Right now, the government pays for about 60% of that bill, and one proposal that could come out is to reduce that subsidy. And that's a big deal for farms. They may not be able to cover as much land with crop insurance if that changes, if the government isn't paying as much of the bill. And when crop prices are where they are now, and who knows what could happen with the weather, that could play a big role in how farms, how it plays out over the next year or so.
Well, and how for those of us, as Paul Jeske said, those of us who are off farm are impacted, right? Because if prices go up, that's something that everyone will be paying attention to.
Right, and it has to do with just the sort of general health of the rural economy. Farms are a big part of that. And another budget item that comes up is if there are automatic spending cuts that are triggered by the situation with the federal budget. Medicare and the reimbursement levels are one thing that could be impacted by that if Congress didn't counteract it. And rural hospitals have a disproportionate level of funding from Medicare and Medicaid government health programs. And so they're very concerned that if those reimbursement payments are cut, that rural hospitals could be even more vulnerable than they are right now.
And how do you think why is that? Because of how, I wonder if you could explain a little bit more about why this might affect the cost of care at rural hospitals.
Well, just because they have such a large proportion of the patients that come are to the hospitals in rural areas, a larger proportion of those patients pay for their care through Medicaid or Medicare. And so if the rates are reduced or if coverage is reduced, fewer people are covered, that has to do with the reversing the mandate on the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
If more people are coming there that are uncovered, then there will be more uncovered care that they're providing. It just may end up they already have thin margins, and it may make their financials in a worse situation.
Right, because, of course, a tax bill also repealed the individual mandate for buying health insurance. Grant, as you look ahead, we've just got about a minute here or so. As you're looking ahead to 2018, though, and as you, with an eye to what President Trump said yesterday, this is something you report on all the time for Harvest Public Media. I wonder what are the big questions and issues you're thinking about, apart from the Farm Bill, sort of big issues for agriculture in this coming year under the Trump administration?
Well, the other big thing that came out yesterday was this sort of roadmap for rebuilding the rural economy. And at the top of that list of this list of items brought up by a group of cabinet members chaired by Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue, the top of the list they put broadband and expanding broadband in rural areas. And the big question for that is how they'll pay for it and how they'll focus where the funding goes and what levels of broadband they're aiming for. When they talked about the numbers, 61% of rural areas have access to what they consider at the federal level to be high-speed broadband, which is 25 megabit download speed, compared to 96% of urban areas have access to that. So to bring up...
Yeah, it's a big issue going forward, right, rural broadband. Thanks for that. Grant Gerlach is a reporter with Harvest Public Media in Lincoln, Nebraska. We'll tweet out some of his stories. Grant, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Train travelers anxious to get from Chicago to Springfield or St. Louis and back more quickly have been waiting for news about faster passenger trains in Illinois, and it seems that wait might be coming to an end. The high-speed rail project is in its final phase with 90-mile-per-hour trains speeding down the track sometime this summer. But that's going to come at a cost, though, of nearly $2 billion. We've got 100 mile per hour trains coming in the future, but according to IDOT, none of these improvements will be implemented until Amtrak installs a new federally mandated high-tech safety system. That system might have prevented that deadly crash that happened in Washington State last month. Joseph Sweeterman is a professor in the School of Public Service and Department of Public Policy and Sustainable Urban Development at DePaul University in Chicago. We turn to him to talk things transit. Joe, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Good to be back.
So what routes are going to be improved here? What cities are going to be served by this high-speed rail?
Well, the big story is the 284-mile Chicago-St. Louis corridor, which is, you know, Chicago's showpiece. We have, you know, the five trains a day on that, plus the longer-distance Texas Eagle. And that's really been doing well ridership-wise. But there's some other things in the mix as well we can talk about. You know, Governor Rauner's been pretty supportive of service to the Quad Cities. And after a pretty tough year for Amtrak, this one's been pretty good here in Illinois.
And how much time will passengers save with high-speed rail?
Well, we're going to hopefully cut about an hour off the route. I think it needs to be clear that some of the earlier talk, hopes, you should say, of 110-mile-per-hour trains or 125, for the moment, has been scaled back to 90. And partly it's due to the fact Union Pacific has, you know, a lot of freight on that route. But, you know, the research shows that the critical thing isn't the top speed, it's the average speed and get rid of these slow zones, and they're adding a lot of second track so trains can pass other trains without some of the long delays. And that's going to shave about an hour off, and that's within our grasp, and hopefully that's going to happen, you know, by next summer.
Now, Joe, as someone who is not as familiar with the Chicago to St. Louis route, but I'm very familiar with the Chicago to Champaign route, I have oftentimes sat on those tracks because of freight traffic. Will that still be a problem?
Well, right now the on-time performance is about 80%, so it's not where we want it to be. You look at Chicago-Milwaukee, which is, you know, seven trains a day, and that's at 95%, and that's really the role model we want. And but freight traffic, you know, this third track is really designed to have, you know, 30, 40 miles of this where trains don't just have to stop, but they can slow down to pass other trains can slow down. Everything keeps moving, which is a big deal. So we'll still have the freight, but the whole environmental impact statement was designed around the idea of these fast trains getting around freight trains. So the optimism is there that we're going to see that on-time performance hopefully push 90%.
Now, of course, Joe, there are always concerns about safety, and especially after the very unfortunate derailment in Washington State last month, three people were killed, more than 80 people were injured. It was a pretty horrific accident. And there's something called positive train control that might have prevented that crash. Can you tell us what that is?
Right. You know, we've had a couple just really, really terrible accidents. And the one in Washington really, you know, tears your heart out because it was so avoidable, it appears. But after an earlier accident in the Northeast Corridor, federal government said all routes that have passenger trains in the United States need to have positive train control, no exceptions. And this is a system that's kind of a computer satellite guided system that stops trains that are in harm's way or going too fast or have safety considerations that the engineer is not attended to. And that could have stopped that train in Washington. The problem is, and it's become quite a soap opera, to be honest with you, is every railroad is putting in their different positive train control systems with different software. And it's got to be designed so every train in the U.S. can communicate with every other train so there's no loopholes. And so in this case, you know, the tracks are mostly owned by Union Pacific. And Union Pacific's been, you know, spending lots of money to put the system in, but it hasn't yet been approved. And Amtrak has to design its trains to communicate with the Union Pacific system. And that's all really drug out. And we're hoping this all gets approved in a matter of months. And I think that's why the optimism is that, you know, we're just approval away from from these trains really being able to go fast with the PTC in place.
And so Amtrak has until December to implement this PTC in Illinois. Does that seem like a realistic timeline to you?
It does. It seems that, you know, one thing I've been waiting for is with the Trump administration, they hadn't appointed an administrator for the Federal Railroad Administration. And that's all, it looks like that's all going to fix itself. And appears that the system, I can't speak, you know, for Union Pacific, but appears the system is working really well. We just need approval. And with that, they can raise the average speed from 79 to 90 and do some other things that will, you know, are not allowable by federal law without PTC in place. So cross your fingers.
And this is something that Governor Rauner is supportive of?
Well, you know, it's been good that our state, despite all its financial the cliffs we're on, you know, there's some optimism in rail right now. The Quad Cities, there's a route that's being worked on and talked about that the governor's been you know, open to considering. And there's no talk anymore of cutting the Amtrak trains that we have. You know, the three that go to Carbondale and two that go to West Quincy and Macomb. And that all seems to be, at least for the moment, on stable footing. And so, you know, I think with the economy picking up, it's and if you go by the new route to St. Louis, the beautiful railroad you see along I-55, the concrete ties and the new signals, and it looks like something you'd see in Europe.
Speaking of Europe and high-speed trains, what's the latest with the – I saw some talk late last year about a new high-speed rail from O'Hare to downtown Chicago. What's the latest with that, Joe?
Sure. It's the or the cocktail party talk of Chicago right now. But the mayor has revived the idea from Richard M. Daley, Mayor Emanuel, that he thinks a global city like Chicago needs a showpiece service from O'Hare, which is, you know, a global hub, to our great downtown. And you look around the world, and most big global cities have that. A business traveler can get off a plane, walk, and have a train every 15 minutes. So he put out the bid proposals for privately funded service. And that's turned into a little bit of a, you might say, a media swirl, because Elon Musk has talked about his Hyperloop, which is like a tube that would zip you to the airport. And we're all scratching our heads saying, is that really possible with private money? Is it, you know, but he claims he's going to submit a proposal to, you know, to move to the next step. And the Chinese are in the background. And other people are saying, let's just get a good semi-high-speed service to the airport, you know, like 80-mile-per-hour trains that are frequent and clean, and then forget this talk of bullet trains, and we'll know in February when the bids hopefully come in.
Oh, that will be something we'll be keeping an eye on as well. I want to thank Joseph Sweeterman, went to DePaul University, for joining us to talk trains. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Those of you who aren't bird enthusiasts likely still know what a snowy owl looks like if you remember Hedwig from Harry Potter. Snowy owls aren't actually native to the UK, and actually they'd been pretty fairly rare to be sighted around our part of the world in the Great Lakes until recently, but sightings are on the rise for the majestic white birds. There were even two sightings this morning, according to eBird, a few reports in Chicago near Montrose Harbor, I'm assuming the same owl, and another down in Sangamon County. So where are all of these snowy owls coming from? Joining me to answer some of these questions is Julia Whittington, director of the Wildlife Medical Center at the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Whittington, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So where are snowy owls usually native to? Where are we normally seeing them in the U.S.?
Well, they're normally not found in the U.S. to a great degree. They're found actually much further north in the Arctic tundra, in Canada, and areas further north. And they're actually not just in the U.S., but they have been noted to be elsewhere in the world, you know, so basically in northern climates.
And for bird enthusiasts, where do snowy owls rank in terms of bird sightings, in terms of how rare and how excited people get when they see them?
You know, they're one of those birds that will bring out even the least enthusiastic birder, because they're just majestic. They are an anomaly, if you will. They're these brilliant white very large raptors with these extremely bright yellow eyes. So they're just amazing. Their plumage is very dense, and they have feathered feet. So, you know, it's really an amazing creature.
Yeah, and if you read about these sightings online, people are really excited about it. I've been reading different reports of things. There was a story, actually a December story in the Chicago Tribune that counted almost 300 more sightings. That was in December. And certainly, if you go by what people are posting online, I mentioned eBird, which is run by Cornell's Department of Ornithology. They're continuing, and you're seeing them. I saw reports in Milwaukee and in Illinois. Do we know why we're seeing more of these owls throughout Illinois this year?
Yeah, I mean, there are some competing hypotheses, but the bottom line is chances are strong that these birds are younger birds, and they have come further south looking for food. Most of the time, it is agreed upon that the normal diet of the snowy owl is the Arctic lemming, and when there has been a particularly robust lemming population, then it allows for a greater number of the year's hatch to survive, those chicks to survive. And then because you have a greater number of snowy owls in a certain territory, the ones that don't have established territories or perhaps are trying to distribute away from related birds will move into new territories such as further south. So we do see this, and it does seem to be associated with particularly good breeding populations of lemming.
And Dr. Whittington, like most birds, male and female snowy owls look different. How can you tell the difference between a male and a female bird?
Yeah, that's actually a great point. And in fact, in raptors, most males and females look exactly the same. So snowy owls are a little bit different in that regard. Usually in raptor species, you can tell the difference from a male from a female because the females are larger, but there's not a distinct difference in plumage. With the snowy owls, what we see is that the young, the immature birds, have much more mottling of the feathers with that gray or brownish coloration. And females also tend to have a more distinct marking with those dark splotches on the feathers. Males, over time, will lose that splotched feathering, and they will become truly white.
So how long will they be around here in Illinois? Do we just get them during the winter?
Usually, yes. Most of the time, snowy owls are going to head back north into the northern climate, the Arctic area, the tundra, and they're going to do that for breeding. So snowy owls have a distinctive breeding behavior where they actually don't nest in trees. They will nest on elevations on the tundra, so they're ground nesters, and the female is the only one who will roost. The male spends all his time finding food and bringing it to her and to the chicks. So they will head back up north to look for that particular habitat to nest.
Dr. Whittington, that said, as you mentioned, these are raptors. What should you do if you see one? I imagine keep your distance, right?
Yeah, enjoy it. Take a moment, stop, really, you know, get a good look at these creatures because they are truly beautiful and amazing. They have an important place in the ecosystem. You know, they're one of the top predators in their ecosystem. You obviously don't want to approach these animals. They are very powerful and very skilled at defending themselves. If one is found injured or ill, of course, you know, take all precautions to protect yourself while also trying to seek help for it. But for the most part, take a minute and appreciate that nature has given you this gift for viewing.
That's Dr. Julia Whittington. She's director of the Wildlife Medical Clinic at U of I's College of Vet Medicine. Dr. Whittington, thank you. We'll all be on the lookout for some snowy owls.
Well, I hope you get to see one.
That does it for us today. As always, you can follow us on Twitter if you search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about, or in the case of today, pictures of Hedwig in Harry Potter. So follow 2NST show for that and see Hedwig, the most famous snowy owl in the world. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by @RobinLynn and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.